Hello and welcome to the show. I'm your host, Jason Knight, and on each episode of this podcast, I'll be having inspiring conversations with passionate product people. If you're involved in product management and want to learn how to become a better product manager, marketer, or product leader, why not pop over to the website onenightinproduct.com, check out some of my other fantastic episodes, sign up to the mailing list or subscribe on your favourite podcast app, and make sure you never miss another episode again. On tonight's episode, we follow the hero's journey and go from academia through a tour in Afghanistan and then back out again into the fabulous world of startup foundership, exiting and then founding again. We find out why data science is just as much about the science as the data, why it really matters where your data comes from, and some of the impacts of getting your data pipelines wrong. We also ask if it's a fair cop or not that data scientists are too academic, and talk about some of the ways they might get a bit more business focused. For all this and much more, please join us on One Night in Product. So my guest tonight is Paul Meinshausen. Paul's a data scientist and entrepreneur who started out as an analyst for the army, so apologies in advance if any of this interview is redacted. He then went on a grand tour through a variety of different data and product roles, even finding time to backpack across Syria. A passionate reader and runner, he also loves to spend time thinking about how data is generated. That's something that comes in handy at his new company AMP, which he co-founded and claims to be able to turn B2C customer communication into a growth engine. Hi Paul, how are you tonight?
I'm doing well, thanks for having me.
No problem. It's good to have you here. So first things first, you are the co-founder of AMP. So who are AMP and what problem do they solve?
AMP is a SaaS business, and we're solving the problem of engaging and providing value for mobile app users over time. Specifically, what is usually referred to as a retention or engagement problem. And rather than handling that problem by retargeting or kind of going back to top of funnel digital marketing kind of channels, we think there's an opportunity to speak directly to users and consumers through the possible channels, for example, mobile app notifications. But in order to make that effective, it needs to be high quality communication. It needs to be personalized. It needs to be relevant, timely, and full of substance. And that's what we're building, a layer of infrastructure and intelligence on top of notification infrastructure to make that possible.
So that's interesting. I guess there's two heads to the snake then in that sense. There's like the one side, which is around the actual ability to deliver the notifications in a good way. But then there's the side where you're actually having to make sure that, presumably with your data science background, that you can actually model and predict and push out good quality stuff, as you say. Would you say that your company is particularly stronger in one or the other, or are you trying to tackle both at the same time?
Well, the first leg that you mentioned, I think, is mostly a solved commoditized problem. So the problem of notification infrastructure in terms of being able to identify a device with an ID, reliably deliver a message to that device at scale with the right throughput and with the right low failure rates, all of that is pretty well solved. It's been a technology that's been around for 10 or more years. Some of the bigger companies in the space, Twilio and others, have solved it pretty well. I think the problem is that on top of that, once you're able to kind of deliver the mail, you still need to know what mail to deliver, to who, when, and what to put in that message. Even though it's a short message, there's actually a lot of content you can fit into it, and you can kind of mix and match, and you need to make the message effective. So we're doing all of that. If you think of notification infrastructure as almost like an operating system, we're the application that sits on top of that operating system to make the messaging effective.
But there's always this strong build or buy argument when you're doing any kind of product development. So did you, or were you ever tempted to sit there and say, yeah, no, this is a commodity, but we're going to build it anyway? Or did you just go straight to using some other existing architecture and then building on top of that?
No, I think from the very, so this is my second company that I founded, a fintech company in India, 2015-16. We did pretty well. But we also, I learned a lot about, and I've worked at other high growth startups. So I kind of know to do what you want to do, you have to really focus on it. And so for us, it was pretty easy to recognize that that part of the infrastructure was handled. And for most companies, most apps very early will set this up, and they're already using something. They're using, if they're in Asia, they're using something like CleverTap, MoEngage. Those, if you're in US or Europe, you might be using Braze or OneSignal. There's a lot of players in the space. You might even be sitting directly on top of Firebase and using Google kind of messaging. you've already got that set up. So what we've sort of said is we can just integrate. We can just work through those APIs. It works seamlessly. You don't need to move anything or rehash anything. We'll just work on top. But there's so many detailed statistical inference and experimentation and attribution problems that we're solving. Like, we had no appetite for solving those more mundane aspects of infrastructure.
That's fair enough. But you're still pretty early in the company's life. I think it's about 18 months old now or something like that. Would you say that you're already at the product market fit stage, or are you still getting towards that and working towards that?
We're almost a year. So it just sort of depends on when you think about having started. I started thinking about AMP or kind of putting it together in March. And I knew my co-founders, I knew I wanted to work with them again. They were folks I'd worked with in the past. And so we kind of came together and talked to a bunch of businesses. And we then went to some investors in the summer, a couple months later. And we said, this is what we're going to build. And this is how we've kind of validated. And they said, great, really interesting. And we were able to, I was in Singapore and still in Singapore at the moment, although, you know, back and forth between here and California, and Sequoia in Asia was interested. And so they funded our seed round. We raised that, kind of closed it all out in August, brought on our first customer in September, and then started building the team. And so, yeah, it's been about a year since we got started, really.
And why was now the time to start that startup? I mean, you say, obviously, you've been thinking about it, but what made you take the plunge at this point?
Well, I guess there's personal aspects to this, and then there's business aspects of this. My previous company was called PaySense in India. I built our data architecture. I was a chief data officer, and that company was acquired in 2019 for a fairly good exit. It was a cash exit acquisition and by PayU, which is a global payments company. And so I was in a different position in December of 2019 than I had been before. And it opened up an opportunity for me to think differently and explore spaces that I was interested in. Although I also had just had my first child. So I was also interested in spending time with him. And for those next couple of months, I thought, oh, I'm just going to kind of explore space, make a few investments, which I'd already done. But this problem that I'd seen at PaySense and several other consumer mobile app businesses that I'd been a part of in product and data science roles, it just seemed really important. And there was a real clear need. And then I just wanted to keep working. I wanted to keep building. And so my co-founders were ready. When I went to them, they were sort of, yeah, this makes sense. And this is something we've talked a lot about. Let's try it. But what we did do was sort of say, look, let's make sure that we can really validate. Let's talk to a bunch of businesses and see if there's a demand. And then let's see if we can fund it, because I think that's also an important barometer or indicator. And yeah, you asked previously about product market fit. Now, I would say I'm always a little suspicious of that concept. I find it I find it overloaded and a little weak, because it all depends on the stage you're at. And, you know, there's, and every time you sort of, it's when people are, you know, ripping the product out of your hands. Well, it's not, it's ripping it, you know, are they early adopters ripping it, or are they large enterprising ripping? You know, you're going to continue to struggle for a long time, to the end of time, and then after it in retrospect, right? But what I do think is that we are in an interesting position where the core problem we're solving is a pretty clear established one. So there's no doubt mobile apps need to retain and engage their users. Like, there's no, like, it's not iffy there. It's just an execution problem. It's execution risk. What's different is that our angle on it is we think of notifications not as just a marketing channel, but actually almost like a proactive UI. They are the entry point for your app. They are what starts the user's journey, if you do them well, in a way that saves them time and gets them to value faster. And in order to do that, you have to actually connect content into your notification. You have to instrument that content, and then you have to basically run really highly parallelized experiments in order to build models that allow you to personalize. There's some product risk there, but we've been working with several customers, large ones, especially since December Gen, and we've seen really good results from that. And I just think we're quite confident that we're in a place where it's clear that this can be addressed and that there's a lot of lift and a lot of value add that can be created for mobile apps.
And that sounds really good. And obviously looking forward to seeing the growth trajectory. But I also, whilst you were talking, thought to myself that when you talk about mobile and targeting via mobile, that's something that I know that Apple, for example, have been kind of against over the years. And I think everyone's seeming to get a little bit more against that these days. And I'm not sure if that actually affects what it is that you're doing, but do you find that you do have to push back against any of the technical or privacy concerns that are coming from these providers, or does what you do fit quite nicely with their models?
I think we're actually positioned well, given the changes that are happening in that space, and actually positioned well from the perspective of getting the dynamic of how businesses interact with their customers in a better mode. Because we all know that the mass tracking invasion, sort of complete disregard for privacy and the kind of sharing across systems is problematic, and it needs to change. What we do is, so the, you know, the changes with Apple and things like that are more oriented towards, can you track a user outside of the app and across the web and things like that? And our thesis is that we sit directly on top of app event data. So we sit on your first in-house data. We use that to understand how you're engaging and how you might want to engage. And if you do that, you don't have to track as much across the space, because you're not trying to find them outside in the world and bring them back. You're sort of speaking to them directly using the address that they've given you, which is sort of the app ID or the device ID. And that's it. And you're using the data that they've shared by participating and using the app. So in that sense, it's actually more secure and more the right relationship, I think, than the more top of funnel advertising one. And given those changes, I think our approach is the more effective one. And I think, yeah, there's been a strong response I've seen, in the sense that because the top of funnel, the sort of top level acquisition is being disrupted, people are having to focus more on what do you do after you've acquired that user. Acquire itself is like a weird concept, right? You don't really acquire someone. It's just you kind of create a relationship.
You borrow them.
That's right. That's exactly right. And so you rent their time, right? And so that, you know, the work you do to sort of extend the lifetime and the journey for that user in your app, I think that's really interesting. And that's where we play. So we're not as much touched by some of the kind of moves that Apple's making.
So one company's problem is your opportunity then.
That's right. That's right.
But you started your career as a data scientist, or an analyst, I think, then a data scientist. And not all data scientists start startups. So what was it that gave you that bug and made you start your first startup? And then obviously you've come back to it with your second startup. Is that something that you've always had in you, or was that something that you developed as your career progressed and you started, for example, seeing what you didn't like about other companies and wanting to start your own good one instead?
My background is something called computational social science. So that's applying computational modeling and computational thinking to human behavior. I did my field research in Turkey. I did a degree there, and then I went back, and that's why I ended up working for the U.S. Department of Defense for a while. Then I went back into academia to study in cognitive science and do research there. And the reason I ended up leaving academia was because I realized that I really value applied settings and I value real life. But I also realized that I love building tools that generate data in order to make better decisions and make better products and make better life. So it's understanding should lead to action, better action. And I felt like when you're in academia, you're often using tools other people have built to try and create data that let you form conclusions. And I saw, you know, right around 2011, 2012, when this was happening, data science was becoming a possibility. And more people who were building technology were building products that generated data that like let you understand and ask questions about how people engage and behave and exist in the world that were fascinating to me. So I think the origins of my entrepreneurship come from wanting to create things that let me understand humans better and ourselves as a society. And I think then over time, I realized the value of the business architecture around that product, around that tooling, around that understanding. And so, you know, I learned why that was important and why it was interesting and exciting. I think that's how I came at it.
Yeah, that's interesting, actually, because one, I guess, comment that people sometimes make around, say, hardcore data scientists and hardcore academics is, well, basically that it's too academic, which obviously in academia makes total sense. But the idea that, for example, it's all very well knowing X, Y, and Z techniques and models and approaches and stuff like that, but if you can never turn that into a business outcome, then yeah, you might as well just stay at university. Now, obviously, you've said yourself that you've tried to move away from that and that that was always an interest area for you. But do you think that it's unfair that people think this about data scientists, or do you think that's actually a fair cop? And it's actually, if we consider sort of business data scientists, something that data scientists should get better at?
It's something I think about. If I think back to my early career in grad school, I cared a lot about understanding. I loved reading papers. I even enjoyed writing them. I liked developing models to try and understand problems. What shook me loose, just my own personal experience, was so I had to pay back some fellowship time. So I took a job with the U.S. Department of Defense. It was a new team that they put together to kind of try and apply computational social science to problems of conflict, specifically irregular conflict in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. I deployed to Afghanistan. And here it was like no longer a question of theory. Here you have a war of conflict. People are fighting. People are dying. And you're trying to sort of say, look, understanding the underlying dynamics of why people make choices like to emplace an improvised explosive device or to inform on an insurgent or to participate in an insurgency could actually lead to better conflict solution and conflict resolution. So it was clear, like, you better reply and you better show results, or like, you have no reason for existence. But not just that, but like, there's a terrible thing happening that you're not able to kind of contribute to in any way. And that was a very brutal, that wasn't like, oh, you're in a business and you know, you need to make some more money. It was like people's lives were quite literally and on a daily basis on the line. And there was a rush associated with that. There was a feeling of like, wow, and also a feeling of a lot of humbling, because you realize that like a lot of the papers you read had nothing to do with what was happening.
Yeah.
And it was not straightforward at all to build things that could actually make a difference. So I realized that like that's what I want to do. I went back into academia to finish a PhD, and I realized that that world, that didn't really do it for me anywhere. So kind of coming back to your question, I can imagine that if I hadn't done that, I don't know that if in a similar experience at sort of tour in business would have shooken me loose quite as much. And so maybe I would have been content to stay more theoretical in terms of just building models and stuff like that. But yeah, now for me, it's much more build product that can actually work. And you can tell if it works by whether people will use it or not.
So what we're really saying is, if academics need to shake themselves out of that, they need to find the closest war and head over there and make everything real.
Yeah.
That's more or less what we're saying.
Yeah. I mean, basically, although hopefully there'll be less and less of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's something to that.
But I mean, that's interesting, actually. I was going to ask a little bit about the Afghanistan stuff. And obviously, I'm sure there's lots of it we can't talk about. But just on a conceptual level, you've touched on it a bit around how that really made, for example, what you were doing real, because there were real consequences to it and you could see that. But was there anything else that you found, I guess, procedurally or culturally working with the army that actually taught you anything about business going forward? So like, I'm assuming that the working culture was kind of different. So did you find any of the stuff there useful to then take forward into the companies that you started and worked for? Or was it very much a distinct part of your career that you look back on, but didn't really have any bearing on what came after?
I would say there were three things that I took from it. The first was that when I deployed to Afghanistan, I was based in Kabul at what was called ISAF headquarters, the International Security Assistance Force. It was a very much big military, working at a small post with 23 generals on the post. But very quickly, I became involved in a program that was being run by U.S. Special Forces, where it was sort of small 12-person operational detachment alpha teams deployed in rural areas to try and take a different approach than the large kind of like large military approach. And so these are small teams where everyone has a specialty. They don't dress the way the big army does. They don't think the way the big army does. And they just try things. And so when I would deploy with them to the village and spend several, you know, days in a row or a week in these rural areas and working with these teams, I quickly realized that like that was the world that I appreciated more than the big space. So I think it was almost like Special Forces of the startup, at least in this conflict, or the startups of the military. So I think that kind of helped me realize that. The second thing I realized was that for all the models and the the inference I wanted to make about behavior, what we were sitting on was massive amounts of very unstructured and diverse sorts of data. We had satellite imagery. We had human intelligence, which is basically just raw unstructured text. We had kind of device reporting where it would be like a device attached to a vehicle that follows it around and just gives you lat long coordinates pinging back constantly. So we had all this kind of information. And if you couldn't join it together and pull it together and make and kind of handle it from an engineering perspective, your models weren't going to work. And so I took that was a point in my career where I took a very strong engineering turn and realized that I really liked and I really thought that you have to figure out the engineering piece if you're going to figure this out. The third piece was that if I learned that you have to embed decision-making within a product, right? So mostly how things were done was you would run a bunch of data, you'd come up with some insights, you'd run some models, and then you generate a report. And the thing is the way a report works is somebody reads it, either they get it or they don't get it, or they get it partially, then they maybe cascades into a decision and it's really loose and it doesn't work, right? What you need is something that can be there next to you as you iteratively make decisions. And statistics aren't good for one-off decisions. They're good for repeatable decisions. And so what we wanted to do, so I realized was like, what's effective is if you can take software, embed the logic and the statistics and the machine learning in the software, in the product, so that then you can use it, you can track its performance over time, and then you can iterate and you can get better. And that's where I was like, okay, you know, building product is really what's exciting me. And then when I moved to, after a short tour back in academia, I was in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I went back, I moved to Singapore, I joined a startup in India. And from then on, it was always like data product. It was sort of saying, it's not enough to build a model. Let's take a model and embed it in a product. And that's what's really exciting. And that's what I've done ever since.
That sounds interesting, the whole concept of effectively having constant iteration, as you say, over decisions and sort of basically bringing agile principles to decision-making as well, rather than spending too long collecting data. So that definitely has some echoes then in the software development world as well, which is pretty interesting. But you describe yourself as a data scientist who cares more about the science than you do about the data. What does that mean specifically?
So data, I mean, ultimately is a lagging, it is an historical artifact that represents some aspect of life, right? It was generated at some point. It's now in a spreadsheet or in a database. It's a series of numbers that represent something in the world, right? And it, by definition, it's a reduced, compressed version of the world. Kind of like think about a subway map. A subway map is not a high resolution depiction of how a city is laid out. Its purpose is to allow you to get from point A to point B. And it shows that in the most simplified way possible to let you follow the map. But if you actually walked up out of the station and tried to get from one point to the other using a subway map, you'd be all wrong, right? That's what data effectively is. You have to know what its purpose is, and you have to realize that it's a representation. And a subway map doesn't change. A subway doesn't change. A subway map is really reliable. But most things that we're talking about when we talk about data today is much more dynamic. It's much more change-oriented. So the science part of data science is asking the question, how did you generate that data? So what tools did you use to create this representation of the world? What limitations were on that? What aspects of how that data was generated affect the way it was generated? And then how do you ask questions of it that then leads to more data, that then leads more? It's totally about an iteration and a process. Data is just like the static version, the static piece. It's the material. I'm interested in the process that happens around the material. That's kind of what I mean by that.
I think it's interesting that point around the subway map as well, though, because obviously you get the classic examples like the London one. They're almost like schematics that don't bear any actual relationship to the physical dynamics of the places that they are. But then you go to Paris, where the subway map is basically geographic, and it makes it a very difficult map to follow. So I think there's probably some kind of parallel that we can draw there between those two approaches and some of the stuff you're talking about interacting with data. So yeah, definitely. I think data for the sake of data, it's kind of pointless. And there's so much of it these days as well, as you know, like you need to be able to find a way through. And there's some of the things you were talking about earlier, like it's almost like garbage in, garbage out, right, as well. So you need to make sure you're using the right data the right way. So definitely agree with that. You also said before this call that it's critically important to understand the relationship between how your product generates data and how it provides value. So what is that relationship in your eyes, and why is it so important?
So most apps have two kinds of data. And in a way for a product person to understand this is usually like a canonical case, or in a clear case is the case of a marketplace. A marketplace has supply and demand. Supply tells you about the assets of the inventory of the business, which presumably is what your user is searching for. So like, you know, the first role I had in India when I moved there in 2014 was with a really fast growing early SoftBank backed startup called housing.com, which was trying to reinvent and create a better way to find housing in urban India, right? So in that case, the inventory is apartments. And it's all the stuff that is the context of the apartment that you know, you consider when you're making a decision. What neighborhood it's in, what are the conveniences in that area, right? Like all of this, it's the inventory, right? And then on the other side, you have the demand side, which is what is a user looking for and all the aspects of their situation that might clue you into their preferences and their value considerations. That's the demand side. That's the user stuff. So when a product is trying to create value, it has to manage both sides of that kind of data and understand how do they capture data from the user in a way that is as sort of minimally intrusive and annoying as possible in order to give them, in order to like understand what they're actually looking for, while also managing a profusion and an immense amount of data on the supply side in order to get them to a decision point. And then to know what is the value you're offering. Is the value getting them to actually rent the apartment, or is the value helping them understand their options in the market? And then they're going to use some other offline process to actually close the deal. I think you kind of have to know those two things, you know, what the final form of value is that you're providing for your user, as well as how you're generating your data, because that's going to limit and constrain your ability to provide that value. I don't know if that was clear. I think like there's a lot of branches we could take off of here, but
we'll do another episode on that one.
Yeah.
And what's an example of maybe a decision that you took off of data at some point in your career that, as it turns out, was really suboptimal? Like you drew the wrong conclusion, or you used data in the wrong way. And what did that teach you?
Yeah, actually, so just to not overwhelm too many examples, I'll just build on this case of housing. One of the things when you're trying to give people a sense of the market is you're trying to sort of say, look, you're looking for an apartment. Here's roughly what it costs. Here are the available options, right? And you want to say that as clearly and as confidently as possible so that you can save them the time of fretting, of worrying, of doing extra work to try and figure out, well, do I have other options, right? And so what we would do is use all of the apartments around the apartment a user was looking for to try and contextualize and understand what is the appropriate price for this apartment, how likely is it to stay available, and these kind of things. So we're using inventory to model something that's available and to model the market. But what that assumed was that our inventory was an accurate reflection of the housing market, all right? And so after a while, I forget exactly how we came upon this, but it was sort of, we needed to double tap on where our inventory comes from. Because houses don't automatically magically land on a website. Like, you got to go and take pictures, and you got to know that the person is putting their house in the market, and they're not just putting up a sign in the window that says for rent or listing in their local newspaper. So we double tapped and we looked, and Housing was, by this time, was a huge organization. We realized the operations team, what they did was pay young guys to ride around on motorcycles the way we do for a lot of the things that we live on these days, right? And to do this operational job of going out and collecting inventory, finding the apartments and getting them onto the site using an app. And what we learned was is that those guys were tended to be young, tended to be bachelors, as in single young men, who tended to live in the outer areas of a city, in like Indian cities. And they were incentivized for quantity, not for representation of the market. So it's kind of like, yeah, get apartments on the site and you get paid, right?
Yeah.
So think about how those incentives are aligned. What they ended up doing was going to these really large flat block kind of buildings where there's tons of flats. They're all basically the same model. And they could go to the manager of that apartment building, find all the apartments in the building, add them onto the site, done, 10 apartments added in one go, they get their incentive, right? Now, that doesn't really help the user because all of those sites, it's like it's repeated data.
Yeah.
One apartment was good enough. It's great to know that there's 10 available, but like it doesn't really give you a sense of the optionality. What they were doing was going to higher end neighborhoods or to the smaller buildings run by wealthier managers who tended to look, you know, wouldn't rent that apartment to a bachelor anyway.
Yeah.
And that bachelor didn't really know how to go and talk to that manager. So we were systematically missing some parts of the market. That's the data generating process. And if you didn't pay attention to that, if you didn't realize that that's how you were getting inventory on your site, you would miss out. And then your models in terms of pricing are going to be wrong. So, yeah.
Yeah. So this just reminds me of those stories, those horror stories about biased AI and things like that, where, for example, Google don't train their data on enough non-white faces and then start getting very problematic results for non-white faces and stuff like that. So it's a different version of that, but it feels very, very similar in many ways.
It is. Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot of questions, you know, about like for AI, it's sort of, is the bias in the model or is the bias in the data? And I would say both are kind of missing the point. The question is the bias in the data generating process? Because the data generating process is an active dynamic thing. Data doesn't get created out of nowhere. It's just like it exists. It's like it's constantly being created. And if it's constantly being created in a way that's biased one way or the other, that's what you can fix. And then the model and the data results can, you have to address those. But if you miss the process, you've missed a big portion of the problem.
Well, and the models just reflect what they were trained on as well, right? So you can't draw inferences outside of, you can, but they're going to be based off of false premises most of the time.
For sure. Yeah. And the way you understand what those premises that might be false is understanding how did I get this data in the first place?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I say garbage in, garbage out, right?
Yeah.
And what advice would you give to an ambitious data scientist looking to follow in your footsteps and starting their own company? Obviously not doing the same thing that you are. You don't want the competition, but some other data-related field.
So I've invested in a few kind of data science companies, AI companies, and I've looked at a lot more than that. And one of the things, and I've also just sort of experienced this when I've thought about different ideas to build, the tricky thing about a data scientist is a lot of the work they do, most people will never understand the details of what they're doing. So the value they're creating is a little bit hidden, but it's also conditional. It relies on the fact that you have some product, right? Some way for people to interact with the model, some way for you to generate the data, right? A mobile app will get users to click stuff, which generates data for you to use. A new form of mobile app will get users to give you information that you wouldn't previously have. It's all about that product part. And so when data scientists who have like been trained on Kaggle and who have worked a lot on models, they'll start and they'll sort of say, how can I commoditize? How can I commodify? How can I productize an algorithm? And how can I sort of say, look, here's a model and I'm going to do this and get the, and focus on the output. And they're not focused on, well, how did you get the input? And like, what is the product around it? Those usually don't end up well. What happens is an investor who doesn't quite understand will see the credentials or they'll see like that they did something really cool at Uber or Facebook or whatever. And they'll say, yeah, let's invest. And then the company will build some cool things using toy data or data that they've, you know, gotten from one, convinced from one company to give them. But because there's no established pipeline, it's not a repeatable process. And then it usually ends up either best case scenario being an acqui-hire kind of a thing where another company will be like, come build this internally, or they just sort of fold. And so my advice for data science folks is team up right off the bat with software engineers, with product people, or learn that stuff yourself. A lot of good ones do know how to write, you know, basic applications. But think first in terms of an experience in a UI and like a product side of value, and then figure out how you can embed intelligence into that. But don't start with the intelligence. Start with the experience. Start with the observable value.
Absolutely. Excellent advice for anyone who's planning to start their Python session this morning. Step away from the code and think about the problem.
That's right.
And where can people find you if they want to chat to you after this around anything to do with what they've heard, or anything about data science or personalization?
Well, our website is www.aamp.com, AAMPE.com. But I'm on Twitter at pmeins, PMEINS. My DMs are open, happy to chat. I'm also on LinkedIn, Paul Meinshausen, my name. You know, you can easily find me. I have a personal site, so definitely open and pretty easy to find.
I'll make sure I link that all into the show notes so people can reach out if they feel the need.
Super.
Well, that's been a really interesting chat, and obviously really grateful to hear about your journey and some of your thoughts on personalization and using data in products. Hopefully we can stay in touch, but yeah, as for now, thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, absolutely, Jason. Really enjoyed it. I've been a big fan. I listened to a lot of your episodes. I think you always manage to create a quality conversation. So appreciate you having me on.
As ever, thanks for listening. I hope you found the episode inspiring and insightful. If you did, I can only encourage you again to pop over to onenightinproduct.com, sign up to the mailing list, or subscribe on your favorite podcast app. Make sure you share it with your friends, and you and they can never miss another episode again. I'll be back soon with another inspiring guest, but as for now, thanks and good night.